Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Matt King. Matt, welcome to Zero Hour, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
Interestingly, someone who has graduated from Cooper Union with a BFA and Bard College with an MFA and has been in the Whitney Studio program and has had a number of selected exhibitions and has won a number of awards, the Faculty Committee Fellowship, the Bard College Milton Avery Graduate School of the Arts Award, the Barbara White Fishman Fellowship, Vermont Studio Center Award, the Ruth, is it Gutman or Gutman?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, the Ruth Epstein Memorial Prize for Excellence in Sculpture and the Steinberg Award for Printmaking. Recently ended up on a farm.
Yeah. I never would have guessed it either.
Which seems sort of interesting to me. So yeah. I thought we might start there and sort of work our way backwards.
Sure thing. I was looking for summer work. And so I went on Craigslist and I'm looking and I see this job and I think it was maybe a 2-sentence ad that said, furniture shop needs supervisor, live upstate, you know? And so I called the person and I meet this charismatic character who, his name is John Hushman. He's a designer and the company was just starting out. And I was getting kind of burned out in New York and, hey, here was an opportunity for something totally different, something that I hadn't ever really experienced before. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity was just something that I couldn't pass up. So I moved and really did kind of isolate myself from the city for 3 years.
So you were able to do your work. Mm-hmm. Right now, what are you doing right now? What brought you to Richmond?
Well, I was hired by the School of the Arts as one of the two new full-time faculty for the Art Foundation program.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the projects that you've worked on. One of the ones you were talking to me about is called Locals.
Sure.
Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, the Locals project was really that came out of being upstate. That was upstate New York, I should say.
Right.
But that was
as opposed to locked up.
Yeah. and really, it happened in this kind of odd way, where one of the things that I wanted to do was to try to incorporate life casting into my work. But for me, I think the fascination came more from the problem of how to do it. Not technically, I knew that, but mm-hmm. but the idea of, okay, you have this set of objects or materials that are going together to form a sculpture,
right.
And if one of those is a cast human head that's a real person,
right.
How do you make the piece not just about the head?
Okay.
Like getting back to the idea of, or getting back to the question of, you know, if someone says, what does this piece mean, or what does it mean for you to use this object mm-hmm. in a piece? I think for me, like one of the things that's sometimes assumed is that we as artists are sort of, that we can translate our work. I'm more interested in the idea of creating a situation with a piece where there are tensions within the work,
right.
Where can contradict one another, where doubt can be created so that what you're looking at is something that you can, in one respect, sort of, you have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It has a presence that you know might make you feel something, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it might not add up, and so it kind of asks you to question it. Mm-hmm. And to me, that kind of questioning is a very, very valuable thing for what art can do. To kind of
talk. I mean, are you able to talk about a particular piece where this kind of thing is going on?
Any of this kind of recent work, I think, mm-hmm. does that. Mm-hmm. You mentioned this Locals project where I had these heads,
right?
Other parts of the of the sculptures may have included a kind of geometric network of materials that are held together with plaster, like just the same.
Right, material. You know, they almost look like, remember those things he had as kids? They had like these round wooden...
Tinker toys.
Yeah, was that what they were, toys?
I think that's what you're talking
about. You know, where you could like, you know, there would be a round thing, look like an Oreo cookie almost, and it had holes drilled in it, and you could put in colored pieces of wood.
Yeah, and then there are objects, a lot of pieces have like plastics kind of floating in them, like suspended. And,
right.
And
well, there was one that I looked at that had colored stones piled up in one part of the piece, and then on top of that was a bag of Lay's potato chips.
Yeah.
Okay, so then, you look at that.
Resting on top of the bag of Lay's potato chips was a mop handle that had been cut, and the other half of the mop makes up the other part of the piece.
So what's going on there?
Yeah, good question. When I was living in the country, one of the things I became really fascinated with was how trash kind of functioned in the landscape. And in that it became, there was something so incredibly dissimilar between the kind of brownness of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And when you would find something like a candy wrap in silver packaging.
Right.
And how it spoke of a kind of human presence. Like I never even saw trash out there as in kind of a negative light, because it's almost like seeing a disco ball in a field or something.
Right.
And I, in this particular piece, which also included the cast of a child's head, I wanted to somehow kind of get that fascination that I had with what it looked like, to get that into the piece and be sort of as fascinating as I would encounter it out in the landscape.
Mm-hmm. Before the interview, you and I were talking a little bit about the concept of play. Can you talk about that some more?
Well, I love the idea of playing in the studio, but
explain
it's
that.
It's a difficult
people.
Word to,
explain,
to use.
Yeah, explain. Can you explain that to people?
Yeah, I mean,
I can take a shot at it if you want, but
no, I'm happy to talk about it. The but the one thing I would caution is when I would say the word play in relation to making art, I think it's important to distinguish between an activity where language is gained through play, or knowledge is gained through play,
right?
And a kind of entertainment.
Oh yeah,
you know. And yeah. But one of the things one of the misconceptions I think about what artists do is that we're sort of reverting to our childhoods or something, and then and especially, I mean, I've actually used toys as objects in my work, and I always kind of have to put my foot down and say, as much as I may talk about the idea of playing, it's not kind of it's not a childish activity at all. What it is a kind of, well, I'd also say it would allow for a kind of misunderstanding, a kind of a way of experiencing your own thoughts in an unexpected way, and which to me is like a very valuable thing.
Mm-hmm.
To sort of, if I have an idea that I want to explore in a piece, and I set myself up to take some things and put them together, and through doing that, learn something new about that initial idea, to me the act of making the artwork is the only way that could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though there is a
do you playful, have an example of something like that?
Well, it's always interesting to me when I do have, say, a studio visit or something, and I have someone else in the room looking at the work with me, and we're kind of discussing it. Recently, I made this piece that had this kind of this large arm kind of reaching into the work, and this person said, "Oh, it reminds me of my father poking out a barbecue,
right?
Like, you know, kind of like moving coals around or something." An image which I really did not see. I had no understanding that was going on. But since then, that's all I can see the piece as. You know, like it's such an odd thing to kind of have this arm reaching in and poking something within the sculpture. You know, how How did I arrive at that image? I can't really say. Hmm. You know, I don't know exactly why. Does it make sense now that that's the meaning that I kind of attach to it? It kind of does. I don't really... That's not really, you know, what it's about, but it's there. Mm-hmm. And to have that happen is something that I couldn't have predicted, that I wouldn't mm-hmm. have wanted to be able to predict.
Mm-hmm. Do you, when you're working, do you move in and out of the work? Do you become totally absorbed by the work? Is part of what you're mm-hmm. doing, in a sense, getting out of your own way and allowing the work to happen, and then stepping back in and looking at it? I mean, is it that sort of back and forth between almost a transcendent experience and then back to sort of ego, intellect? Is it any good? Isn't it any good? Does it work? Doesn't it work?
You're reminding me of this this kind of funny conversation that I had with a friend when I was living at the farm in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. I had built this studio. You know, this is like my dream studio. I built this giant space. And it was great. And as soon as I got it done, I was talking to a friend, and I said, "Oh, I need a really good chair." And he kind of made this funny face, and he's like, "What do you need a good chair for?" And the act of looking in the studio is so critical.
Nah.
To kind of see the piece mm-hmm. and be with the piece in a way that is that's not active physically,
right.
Like that's as much a part of the work in the studio as anything else,
mm-hmm.
and so you have these moments of just kind of the, you know, you can be making something and maybe it takes you all day to sort of sand something so mm-hmm. it's perfect,
mm-hmm.
and some days you just sit there and you look all day,
really all day,
and you may not make a decision,
right.
you know, but you may have some ideas about another piece. And you do kind of get lost in it, but there is something meditative about that it's a kind of thought that that really you have with the piece, and only with the piece, only mm-hmm. because of the piece.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to imagine the object to kind of get you going, but to sort of imagine it changing as you're making it
mm-hmm.
is something that's entirely different and is really valuable to me. You know, as if I'm drawing, if I'm kind of setting up, some kind of a system or something that may allow me to make something, if I buy an object and I kind of get them in the studio, I put things together, kind of see where it's going. When I actually stop and look and have to think about what the next step is, there's a moment there when it's not that I'm lost in the piece or something, but that the experience is uniquely because of the piece.
Right.
And that, to me, is like the really kind of valuable moment where I couldn't imagine that happening any other way. I wonder how that relates to viewing work. If for you, as someone who looks at art, does that happen to you where you're kind of, not that you're losing yourself, but that you're experiencing something that you would be unable to experience otherwise?
Because of the piece. Ah. I think it depends on how much you bring to the piece, how much you uh-huh. understand about what the artist is doing, how much history you bring to it. And then just that intangible, whether or not it even connects.
Yeah.
You know, whether you want to even want to look at it.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of go, move on. You know, the next thing.
That's always been fascinating to me. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's funny because I'll have, you know, students always want to know, like, you know, what do you like? You know, it's not a sad answer.
How do I get an
answer,
A in this class?
The sad fact is, this. I mean, I like so much art, but I love so little.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only, but those experiences with those pieces
mm-hmm.
is, that experience is so valuable. Like when you actually make that connection that I think you're talking about, when it does happen, there's nothing else like it.
Well, I can tell you, it's the strangest thing. I mean, I've been surrounded by art for years. My wife's an artist. You know, I've made installations and things, although I don't consider myself an artist. But a friend of ours has this little painting on her wall. And all it is a painting at dusk with these sort of black forms that look like they might be maybe, you know, hemlock trees or something. And the sun is setting, and it's a snowy kind of field. And, I mean, it is my soul.
Uh-huh.
I look at that piece, and it is, I tried not to think about it too much, but it's just sort of really that dreary. But I couldn't tell you why.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that piece, and it just.
Does it matter to you that you know the person who made it?
No.
See, that's something I also find really interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, how you can have such an incredibly rich experience with something that was made by someone who you don't know.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, looking at the work of someone I do know is a very different process. Because I know them and I know their work so well, they come and they say, well, like my wife, for instance, will come and say, what do you think? And I'll walk out in the studio. And I'm certainly anything but an art historian or art critic, but I've been looking at work for a long time. And she'll say, what do you think? And I'll say, well, obviously you're in transition. And she'll say, oh. And I'll say, you know, it's not there yet.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is. And then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I'll come out and I'll go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see where it has gone from one visual statement that was very complete and very well done and very organized, because she changes a lot, a lot more than most artists. And then there's like this risk-taking, playing, chaos kind of, where she's making messes and it's not working and, you know, and the forms are changing and the shapes are changing and, you know, she's an abstract painter, and it just, you know, you look at it and you just kind of go, phew, you know, well, there goes that art, you know. And then slowly you start to see this thing start to take form again that you can't even articulate how that has happened. I had a young student ask me about his work, and he's a very good painter. And I said, the thing about your painting I like the most is that it shouldn't work, but it does. I said, that really, you know, I said, I look at this thing and I look at these shapes and I look at what you've got here and I look at it and I think, this shouldn't come together.
Yeah.
But it does.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how to define come together. What is that, you know?
Sure.
Come together? I'm sorry. What does that mean? But it just, you know, it's a visual.
And how do you allow yourself the confidence to kind of make those mistakes and enter that kind of messy playing kind of, you know, where
you?
Well, I mean, part of it is you just do it. Mm-hmm. You know, you just force yourself. Some days you force yourself to get in there and just kind of get messy, you know.
But you find that as a part of your process, clearly.
Yeah, and in fact,
and a part of your growth.
I often sometimes set up problems that I know I'm not going to be able to solve in an easy way.
Right.
And I think part of that is like, you know, what sculpture can do is that you can, you know, I can make something that I know is going to tip over and start building it. And then when it tips over, I got to deal with it.
Right.
And so it forces me somewhere else with the work. But I think that there's a lot, you know, you have to be kind of a self-confident artist in order to get there. You know, it's hard to, it's hard to hit that kind of wall and enter that space of like, of real unknowing and allow yourself to kind of laugh about it. And then move forward,
right?
You know, and fail, and you know, throw the piece away, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But what an interesting way to kind of, you know, live with your own decisions. You know, to kind of allow yourself to do that, to make those kinds of mistakes.
So why art and not medicine? Or I mean, you're obviously a very bright guy. Why? Do you know why? Was there ever a time when you thought about, oh, I think I'll be an engineer or I'll be a...
Really early on, Well, actually, not really. You know? I mean, there was a time when... There was a time when I considered something scientific.
Yeah, you know? I get that from you, but in
a very kind of vague way. And yeah. I think that really it was, I was a young person trying to define myself. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what that was.
Right.
It was more, you know, I wanted something, some kind of intellectual pursuit, and that was the model that I think mm-hmm. I could kind mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. put my head around. Mm-hmm. But no, I'd wanted to make art for just a long, long time.
Really?
It was always something that I did. I didn't know I was going to be a sculptor.
Right.
You know, I mean, and most people, most young artists who end up making sculpture mm-hmm. don't enter mm-hmm. thinking they're going to do that.
Right.
It's just not kind of expected as an art
form. Well, you don't start making sculpture, I mean, because it's much easier to be drawing, much easier to be painting.
Yeah, it's not culture. It's not taught.
I mean, when was the last time you saw a sculpture class in some, you know, middle school or high school? I mean, you know, sure. It's more like, you know, here's some, you know...
And how often do you go into someone's home and see a sculpture?
See a sculpture, right, yeah. Exactly. Exactly, so, right. I mean, you go downstairs in our house and it's all paintings. We have three sculptures down there.
But I think but I think what happens is that students, including myself, very quickly, once I was exposed to that, to the act of building, mm-hmm. like I had been building for a long time. I had sort of always been a tinkerer, always used my hands and constructed things. And so once I kind of understood how I could use those, that process, you know, and mm-hmm. and feel how kind of rich that process was for mm-hmm. me mm-hmm. And use it toward a kind of intellectual pursuit.
Right.
Then it kind of all came together really mm-hmm. quickly. Mm-hmm. And I stopped painting and I mm-hmm. started making mm-hmm. things. But yeah, no, maybe I don't ever really regret, you know, not going into another type of practice, but except maybe, you know, when I'm battling it out with some big thing that I have right. to carry down the street or doesn't fit through my door or whatever. You know.
Why the heck didn't I go into advertising anyway?
Well, my partner is a poet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. And we always laugh about how she, you know, her life's work is on a jump drive, her entire body of work,
right,
you
of course,
know, and here I schlep stuff, and it's, you know.
Talk about the satellite pieces. I mean, these are pieces that are made from, as you said, party objects.
Yeah, this was a project that I was doing right around, I guess, around 2000.
Uh-huh.
And I was making these floating sculptures that were made from helium balloons and mylar tape and bendable straws and hot glue, and they were very lightweight to the point where when I filled the balloons with helium, they would float.
Right.
And I would take these pieces and kind of let them go and let them float away and basically allow them to be discovered by someone else in some unknown setting.
Uh-huh.
My kind of imagined ideal state of discovery for these pieces would be sort of like caught up in a tree,
right,
or, you know, a telephone pole, or in a backyard,
and, right,
and I love the idea that when they actually landed that they would look like a party had happened.
Uh-huh.
And I was at the time like, you know, wireless technology was just starting to sort of saturate our culture.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Cell phone towers and all that were just kind of like becoming a real thing. And in the art world itself was just like really kind of gung-ho with technology and art.
Right.
And I was kind of coming at this from the position of like an outsider, you know, as someone who's very technically minded, but who wasn't I was a little reluctant to jump on that bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to do it in a way that was a little more tongue-in-cheek,
right,
and still within the kind of material language,
right,
that I had been working in. And so here was a way I could kind of make the, you know, it's like the ultimate technological achievement, the satellite, and send them off and have them be about a party and about, you know, it's the year 2000 and, you know,
was there any way for these people to get back in touch with you?
Yes, after a while I started attaching a recorded CD. Mm-hmm. That it was a voice, my voice, that was kind of computerized, digitized, so it sounded like a computer was talking to you. And the idea that this was your recovery disc, and if you got it, if you played it, it would it was kind of absurd. It would give you my it didn't say this is an art project by Matt King so and so. I created a website for the project, and I gave the website an email address.
Right.
I gave the email address, and it was a computer voice that said, "This is an SPF 30 personal communication satellite, and there were parrots squawking in the background, and there were video game noises, and actually I had a Japanese man translate the script in Japanese, and he gave a Japanese version of it at the end, and it kind of looped.
Just in case it went to Japan?
Exactly, yeah. Okay, it seemed like it would be like somehow more authentic, like authentically technological if it had right. that kind of possibility. And so like I love the idea of it, of this being found by some farmer or something.
Right.
You know,
who speaks Japanese.
And it happens to have, you know, like access to the web. And,
right.
And so I would let these go. And then I started making pieces that actually
All right,
had,
so hang on a second. Did you get any back?
I never did. No.
No.
I have no idea where these things went.
Huh.
And I also had a... some pieces that had a little voice chip on
right.
them.
Uh-huh.
So you could, if you pressed the button on the piece, it would talk to you.
Right.
And those pieces were more empathetic. Like the voice wasn't the voice of, say, a scientist. It was the actual voice of the sculpture.
Did you ever check into where you let them go? Do you have any idea how high they would go before they would burst? Or
no, I
so you have no sense of whether or not they got into a jet stream or
my
they all
my
went
guess
straight
is that
into the ocean or
some of them one of them I launched from I had a residency in Normal, Illinois.
I'm sorry, where?
Bloomington, Normal, Illinois.
Normal, Illinois.
Yeah, so
we're in Normal, Illinois.
I was there.
Sending up satellites.
Yeah,
okay.
as a visiting artist at Illinois State University,
uh-huh.
and I did a launch on the clearest, most beautiful day, and the satellite took off and it ran maybe 50 feet horizontal with the ground, and then it started going up. And it went so far away, so high, that I just lost sight of it. I
right.
mean, this thing took off. So I have, and this wasn't, you know, coming from
right.
Illinois. I have no idea. None.
Probably brought down some jetliners. Probably.
Well, this is the kind of tragic thing about the project, is this was in 2000, and you know, and I moved back to New York, and after 9/11, I couldn't do the project anymore. It just felt like the last thing that we needed was things floating around the sky
right,
in
exactly.
New York, you know. Yeah, so right. that whole project got grounded pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know,
couldn't really do it.
Exactly. Well, Matt King, speaking of things that are not floating around in the sky anymore, we're out of time. So I want to thank you for joining us. And I want to thank our listeners. And we hope to see you for lunch again on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.